This program is brought to you by RTS on iTunes U from the Distance Education Department of Reformed Theological Seminary. For more information on RTS degrees and programs, please visit us at www.rts.edu or call 1-855-854-6920.
Okay, the paper. Essentially, I'm asking you to do a biography paper, and the syllabus asks you to see if you can find at least one biography that's around 200 pages or so. And I trust you've been able to do a little looking to find that. I know several of you have asked me about it, and I want to give you my parameters for finding the materials. Every now and then, someone wants to do some work on an individual and have a hard time finding a biography or a longer one, but you have access to some of their works. I am agreeable, if it's somebody you really want to study and you just can't find a longer biography, to find, let's say if you find a 100-page biography on that person, why don't supplement that with a minimum of 100 pages of reading their writings, okay? And then you can write your paper as a combo, you know, kind of rehearsing their life story and then talking about their writings. I'm certainly want to give you the flexibility in writing the papers to write it in a way that will be helpful to you. If you prefer to emphasize in the paper the individual's life, if it's somebody like Luther, there's so much in his life, you want to do that, fine. But if you would like to emphasize more their theology or thoughts, that's okay too. I don't mind. For example, I'll just pick one out of a hat. How about William Carey? Some of you want to do William Carey, the famous 18th century, early 19th century Baptist missionary. Or if you want to do William Carey, you might decide, I'm so intrigued by some of his writings, because he was a very seminal thinker in terms of methodology in missions. If you would like to write your paper more on that, it would be more helpful than just do a short section biography. But there's so many interesting things about his ministry in India. If that's more intriguing to you, then write your whole paper on his life. Okay, does that make sense? So I want you to make the paper work for you. And sometimes I suggest you may want to write it like this. If you think through how you might want to use that paper in teaching a Sunday school class or an illustration in a sermon, you know, a way that would be useful to you, I'm fine with that. So I don't have rigid standards for this. This is not technically a research paper so much as it is a biographical paper. That's why I try to categorize it that way. And I don't expect a million footnotes. Now, if you use multiple sources and you're quoting directly, you need to. But if you're using one main biography, you don't need to footnote everything because I know where you got it. Okay, unless it's a direct quote, do that. But I do. The one thing I would like for you to do at the end of each paper, and this can just be one page or half a page, at least attempt to ask the so what question. All right, what can we learn from this person's life or ministry that applies to the church today? At least make an initial attempt to think about that. Okay? But I'm wide open. I think the parameters 16th, yes, 16th to 18th century, and let's limit it to Europe. Now, I don't want any Americans. They're nice guys, and a lot of cool folks in the 18th century America, but let's limit it to Europe, okay? We'll deal with you'll get more of American Christianity and church in the world. We'll talk about that in there. All right, any specific questions about that? Does that make sense? All right. Well, final comments about Zwingli. As you saw in the video, that he dies in the Second Papal War, and his life is cut short there in 1531. But I want to say this about Zwingli. He truly did have a vision for a Protestant Europe. And one of the reasons why the Zwinglian reform spread is he wanted his disciples to spread the word, to continue to reform the church, and particularly in some of the imperial cities in southern Germany as well as Switzerland. that this network of churches could have a shared liturgy and ecclesiology and that kind of thing. So he did want to start a church planting movement. He was concerned about more than just what happened in Zurich. So he was a visionary, but because of his life coming to such an abrupt end that he's not able to fulfill that vision, that's for sure. All right, let's in our last hour together, well, with the discussion groups, it's going to be less than that, but let's talk about in a little more detail these Anabaptist types. All right, back to our diagram. The Anabaptist movement, or at least those that we refer to as the Swiss Brethren, okay, that's a term that is used for these Anabaptist followers of Conrad Grebel and Mantz there in Zurich, are going to merge out of the Reformed tradition. So if we have to make a linkage there, we would do that. And let me just state up front, to reiterate, I think I've said this before, for those of you of Baptist heritage in within this country, the linkage to the Anabaptist movement is more of a dotted line than it would be a straight line. Obviously, the emphasis on believers' baptism, some of the other points we'll talk about Anabaptist, you can see a parallel. Just like I hope you've been able to see some parallels with Zwingli. In many ways, Zwingli is the father behind the Baptist tradition. For example, his understanding of the Lord's Supper is symbolic and a memorial. That is common fare in more Baptist and congregational churches also. But really, the English Baptist is the direct heritage of Baptists over in this country. We will talk about that eventually. We are going to get to it when we talk about the English Reformation, and we'll talk about Helwes and a guy by the name of John Smith, who and these men will have some contact with Mennonites a little bit later in the 17th century, the parallels. But just so you're not confused about this, when we're talking about Anabaptists now, we're talking about a particular scattering of multiple movements that are popping up over Europe that are not really directly related to what we experience as the Baptist tradition in America. Okay? That's going to come more from the Puritan English Baptist. But we'll tell the rest of that story when we get to it. Although there's overlap, okay, with what the Anabaptists are about. But there's some things that, you know, the Anabaptists were about that, you know, contemporary Baptists wouldn't want anything to do with. So you might be glad for that, too, not to be identified completely with it. Those of you online, if you didn't hear it, the question had to do with distinguishing those that believe, embrace believers' baptism from this notion of Anabaptist or rebaptizer. Well, the term, as you might imagine, the term Anabaptist was a term that was created by, was a pejorative term created by those that were opposed to the Anabaptist. And the word just means rebaptizer. And of course, that goes back to the ancient church with some of the division at the during the times of persecution, and also during the time of St. Augustine, when you had separatist groups that left the Catholic Church that were baptizing again their followers. And so there's a long history behind that. So the Reformers are bringing that title back again and using it to label the folks that are practicing believers' baptism, because from their perspective, if you believe infant baptism is legitimate, then they are being baptized again, and so they use the term rebaptism. Now, for the Anabaptists, obviously, would not have accepted that. They would have said, "No, we don't consider infant baptism to be legitimate. So this is your true first baptism." Okay, so yeah, you have different perspectives coming from, but that term does emerge at the in the 16th century, and of course it conjured up all kind of ideas in people's mind, because, you know, to call someone a rebaptizer, boy, that's a bad thing. You don't want to be one of them, and so it was a negative term that was used toward them. But it's been identified particularly with the 16th century to distinguish it from a separate Baptist movement which comes out of England. Okay, so it is helpful in that way, that when we typically we use the word Anabaptist, you think about these 16th century movements. And although, you know, the English Puritans would refer to the English Baptists, those old Anabaptists, you know, if you don't, I mean, they would resurrect that old pejorative term also. But it's helpful, I guess, in that way. I hope that's not too confusing. The English Baptist movement is not going to emerge till the early 17th century, okay? During that period, we'll call the Elizabethan Puritan movement. And we'll talk about the four different groups of Puritans, of which one of them were the Separatists, okay? And the Separatists were the ones that practiced believers' baptism. And there's kind of a long journey in there of where they kind of clarified their thinking. I mean, for a while, those that embraced believers' baptism didn't immerse. They just used effusion, pouring. That's what everybody did. And, you know, eventually some of them get to the point, well, we think only immersion is correct. And then you have some of them struggle with, well, how can we take it upon ourselves to baptize? But what authority do we have to baptize people? And so there's some of the English Baptists that will be baptized by Mennonites in Holland. And they feel like, well, this is a legitimate church group that has a history and we recognize their ministers, and so we can receive baptism from them. Rather than just individual believers taking it on themselves to baptize one another, there was still a sense for a long time, well, you know, what really right do we have to do that? Because there was a perspective on church order and decency, and it's only the clergy that baptize. And so there was a time where there was a struggle. So this thing didn't just happen overnight. Okay, it evolved in time. But yet, certainly overlap, in particular when the English Baptists connected with some of the Mennonites in Holland in the early 17th century. And so that would be probably the most direct linkage with that group, because some of them will move back to England and establish some of the first Baptist churches in England. And then it's from those churches then that you have Baptists come over to this country. And there were Mennonites that came over too, Anabaptist groups that would come over. Did that get at it? Okay. Well, it is. And, you know, particularly since it's kind of like this. There are some great history books on Baptist history, but because they're not outstanding individuals that kind of stand at the headwaters of that particular movement, the history is harder to trace. It can be traced, and there are fine historians that have done that, but there are just more dotted lines because it was more of a spontaneous movement. I mean, Luther's organizing and orchestrating the whole thing. Zwingli's organizing and orchestrating the whole thing. Calvin, too. The Anabaptists, I mean, they fought among each other as bad as they differed with the other. So there was not a structure which kept them within certain boundaries. And so their relationships to one another is kind of hard to trace, and even historians will categorize Anabaptists differently. I'm going to give you one paradigm in a minute that talks about four different groups of Anabaptists, but you know, you could argue for some other ways to slice the pie, if you would. So in looking back, we have to try to think of some ways, all right, how can we understand how this thing developed and played out? When my friend who's a Mennonite actually goes to a Presbyterian church, but theologically he's a Mennonite. He's a pacifist, and he holds Anabaptist views in a number of different, and would personally identify himself with the Anabaptist movement in his own theology. But he and his family are members of a Presbyterian church. But this is just kind of where he's not Mennonite. So I think you can talk about Anabaptist in a person's thinking with some of the principles that are typically identified with that. I mean, some of you in here may feel like, well, you know, gosh, maybe that's who I am. All these years I'm wondering, you know, I've identified with this group and kind of what they're about, which is different from being a part of an organized Anabaptist, group like Mennonites or Amish, that kind of thing. Okay. Well, if y'all are confused, I am too. No. We're going to keep visiting this chart, and hopefully by the time we're through, there'll be more solid lines and less dotted lines, okay? It'll make sense. But it, To tell the story, it just takes a while. I like this map because this, I think, visibly gives you a sense of how these groups spontaneously emerged all over Central Europe. And the Swiss Brethren, here's Conrad Grebel, one of those that was rebaptized on the time of Zurich, is one particular group. A number of them, after they're removed from Zurich, are going to spread into southern Germany. You've got groups like the Hutterites in Moravia. We're going to talk about them. We've already mentioned the Zwickau prophets. Remember I just said something about them were some of the German Reformed thinkers that felt like Luther hadn't gone far enough and were kind of end times focused. And Karlstadt, remember the one that basically Luther had to kick him out of Wittenberg when he comes back. He felt like he was taking things too far. And in the Zwickau prophets and Karlstadt got identified with the Peasants' Revolt. So we're talking about mid 1520. So this is early on, some of these, the Anabaptists there. But simultaneously, you've got these other groups. We're going to talk about the Melchiorites and what happened in Munster, where they really got carried away. And it got real ugly and kind of forever scarred the Anabaptist movement there. And then the Mennonites, we typically identify them as one of the ongoing Anabaptist groups. And Menno Simons will really renovate the Anabaptist movement and try to pull people together. And that's his long term has been a significant group. And then we're going to talk about these Socinians, who are basically Unitarians. So some of the Anabaptists got away from the doctrine of the Trinity. And so that became problematic. And then Pilgrim Marpeck, some of the southern German brethren. And interesting thing about him, one of his passions is that he tried to unify the Swiss Brethren and the Hutterites, and he wanted to try to bring these groups together, never able to do it. Their differences were just too strong. But even among the Anabaptists, there wasn't a sense it's every man for himself. Many of them said, you know, we really want to do that. And that's kind of a misperception sometimes that, you know, if the Anabaptist heritage is so individualistic, there was no sense of the body of Christ. And that's not really true. There are a number of instances of why they tried to get together and fellowship and do ministry together as they could. All right, here are the four categories I'm going to use for us for our purposes. The Anabaptists proper, which are the Swiss Brethren we've talked about, Hutterites and Mennonites. Then the Radicals, the Zwickau prophets, the Melchiorites, and then we're going to talk about this fiasco that happened in the city of Munster, which turned so much of the Protestant church against the Anabaptists. And basically, see, we told you so. And what did the Catholics say to Luther? See, we told you so. This is what happens. You put the Bible in everybody's hands, and they're going to go crazy. Then the spiritualists, the Zwinglis, this is more mysticism. There are, and Zwingli is not the only group, but there are still groups of Zwinglis. There are not many in existence today. But we're going to talk about different groups of spiritualists who were mystics. Many of them had continued on the honoring the imitation of Christ, Thomas a Kempis, and the German theology. Remember, I talked about the Theologia Germanica that Luther had published, this work of German mysticism. And a focus on that continued among some of these spiritualists. And then the rationalists, these are your anti-Trinitarians or Socinians. And while not a large group at first, they will flourish in some areas and are going to spread in Europe. So I think these four categories at least assist us in getting a handle on it a bit as we work through this. So let me talk about a few of these individuals in the moments we got left so we can make some progress on here. Jacob Hutter. And you may have heard of groups called the Hutterites or the Hutteran Brethren. I think there may be still a few pockets of them even in the United States today. But Jacob Hutter was an Anabaptist leader. He actually was a maker of hats and did his ministry in Austria and Moravia. He had a real passion to model the apostolic community in Acts, which was a lot of what informed the Anabaptist vision. We really want to recover in its details the early church, as we see in the scriptures. Now, when Blairock is killed, one of the Swiss brethren who had become one of the leaders in Moravia, they had fled, out of, some of them out of Switzerland toward Moravia. Hutter becomes the leader of that group, and some of them had ended up in Moravia, finding safety there for a while. There were some disagreements among them, but one of the things that happened, beginning in the 1530s, so these groups of Anabaptists in Moravia, is they began economic sharing, or common property, if you would. This is one of the issues that Pilgrim Marpeck would have with some of them, because the Hutterites believe this is what we see in the book of Acts, and this is what we have to do. This is what it means to be a faithful Christian. Is that we have no one owns private property. We all hold the property in common. Marpeck and other Anabaptists will say, we're not sure the gospel demands this. You can freely choose to do that if you want to have a communal life together, but is it absolutely mandated? Well, the Hutterites, at least in Moravia, argued that that was the case. So that's, you know, one unique expression of their situation there. But Ferdinand I, remember, I don't know if you remember him, he is the brother of Charles V. He is the king of Hungary and there in Moravia, and he determined to root out the Anabaptists in his domain. He tortured and burned many of them. And Anabaptists in Moravia hid in caves, forests, and basically had to practice their faith in seclusion. Yes?
Was there a connection between the Moravian Anabaptists and the Hussites?
I'm not familiar with a linkage there. I have no doubt that they, you know, probably there was some interaction, but they're very distinct groups, and I don't think there was ever any merging of those groups. That's a good question, though, since they were in that same area. Now, Thomas Munzer, he's going to be a little different. Saxony, all right? This is the where Luther was. And he became the pastor in Zwickau, and he combined this strong anti-clerical spirit of the time with his own emphasis on the inner light, kind of a mystical understanding of the faith. And he believed that the kingdom of this world is now being given over to God's elect, and he had an apocalyptic side to his understanding of the coming of Christ in what is transpiring in our time. A lot of innovations in worship and in the German liturgy among the Anabaptist groups that he had oversight of. His group, many of them are eventually going to connect with the Peasants' Revolt in the Black Forest. And they were convinced that this is a part of the Last Judgment of God, that the end is imminent, and he eventually is going to be captured, tortured, and executed by 1525, and was killed as a part of the larger peasant war. Hans Hutt, here's a connection to Munzer. He heard him preach, and he had caught on to this end times mentality also, and joined in a part of the Peasants' Revolt, and gave some intriguing interpretations. When the body of Munzer was captured, and also another one of the Anabaptists that was not buried but left on spikes, you know, just to show what's going to happen to you Anabaptists, he identified these two men as the two witnesses of Revelation chapter 11. So, he is one of the date setters among the Anabaptists. He decided that Christ was going to return on Pentecost in 1528. Naming the date for the second coming of Christ emerges here, at least in among some of these Anabaptists. He is baptized by Hans Dink in 1526. He founded churches all over Austria in Moravia. It was the reformer Bucer who referred to Hans Hut as the Apostle of Austria because of his travels. But he preached believers' baptism, and he appointed other missionaries and was convinced of the second coming of Christ and the necessity of the rapid spread of the message. And his idea was that we need to find the 144,000 to be prepared for the millennium. By 1527, he is captured, and he actually died of smoke inhalation while he was in prison. This sense that, you know, the kingdom of God is being restored, the millennium may be around the corner, the Lord is coming back soon, was rather common among a number of the Anabaptists. Now, Balthazar Hubmaier is, I would say, among the Anabaptists of the 16th century, stands out as one of the intellectual leaders. He was a very astute theologian, had his doctorate in theology. We definitely don't want to leave you with the impression that, you know, all these Anabaptists were poor peasants that had very little education and really were not careful students of the scriptures and that kind of thing. Hubmaier would stand out as Exhibit A, contrary to that perception. Left a number of writings. He actually had spent some time in Zurich. And we have copies of some of his treatises that he wrote against Zwingli and his understanding of the baptism. Very interesting dialogue between those two men. Hubmaier took more of a moderate approach and believed that there might be time where, you know, Christians have to work alongside with the secular authorities, where most Anabaptists tended to move very rapidly away from that. He actually participated in the second disputation there in Zurich. Well, he left Zurich and spent some time in Austria and gathered followers around him. He is eventually rebaptized himself and personally rebaptized about 30 other followers in rites of defense of believers' baptism. In 1525, when the peasants were defeated and Zwingli was openly opposed to him, he was temporarily arrested and recanted, but then was released later. And this happened on a couple of occasions with Hubmaier. Well, by 1526, he ends up in Nikolsburg, and there are 12,000 Anabaptists in that area. It gives you an idea of, in a local area, that their numbers could really increase, because the common people were finding this teaching very attractive. Yes, it was very radical, but they were in a radical mood to separate themselves not only from the secular power, but also from the hierarchy of the church in some very serious ways, and the Anabaptist doctrines made sense to them, and they could read these things in the scriptures. Well, Hubmaier is arrested by Ferdinand again in Austria, and he reconverts to Roman Catholicism, or at least makes that public commitment to do so for a while. So really struggled with the issues of standing for his faith. But in 1528, he was burned at the stake in Vienna. And his wife was drowned in the Danube River. Most Anabaptists rejected his views of church and state because, as I mentioned, he's a little more moderate. But certainly he's been influential in terms of his laying out the Anabaptist argument related to believers' baptism. All right, now the Munster Rebellion. This is the dark corner of the Anabaptist movement, and let me just tell you a little bit about what happened there and why it almost destroyed the whole movement because of the violence that took place here. Melchior Hoffman had been in Strasbourg, and there he had met some Anabaptists. Strasbourg, by the way, in the early years had become one of the havens for Anabaptists. Bootser and others there tried to have a charitable spirit, dialogue with these men. And there were a number of the Protestant leaders that really had trouble with this notion that, you know, we need to kill all the Anabaptists. They believed it was error and couldn't accept that. And while some of the Protestant princes did put to death Anabaptists, there were places of safe haven at certain times where, Protestants allowed these people to be in these areas. Now, I should say this, because I don't want to confuse you when I say the term Protestant and then Anabaptist in the same sentence in two different ways. Typically, the Anabaptists did not consider themselves a part of the protest, if you would, okay? They considered themselves a third major movement, distinct from Lutherans and later Calvinists, those that are protesting the faith. Remember that word first showed up in 1526 at the Diet of Speyer. But the Anabaptists saw themselves as a new thing and kind of distinct, and believed these Protestants had compromised too. And this is the new thing that God is, way that He is restoring the church. And they believed that they alone were going to be able to reconnect with the early church. And by that they meant first century church. Remember, I early on had talked about the very first lectures when we rehearsed kind of the history of Christianity up until this area, that in addition to your perspective on tradition, your view of history kind of determines where you find on the continuum. And the Anabaptists were definitely the ones that believe essentially the church, went into a tailspin and its demise right after the time of the apostles. And they really had a notion, we're going back to first century Christianity. And they didn't accept really much of the writings of the early fathers as very valuable. It's just scripture alone. And in that way, they were kind of distinct, because most of the other Protestants valued much of the ancient church in its heritage. Now, they had varying degrees of that, but the Anabaptists really did want to throw it in the trash can and set the can on fire.
How much did the Anabaptists believe in faith alone?
Ooh, hold that for a minute. That's important, because some Anabaptists are going to reject justification by faith alone, like Menno Simons. Not all of them, but some of them did. And let me tell you why. Because all of them are going, oh no, you're kidding. I thought these were the truly spiritual Christians. Not all of them, but here was the issue. I can say this definitely, almost all the Anabaptists talked about justification by faith alone being a dangerous doctrine. Let me tell you why. Because they believed that the fruit that was born out of it was a lackadaisical spirit that they saw among many of the Protestants in being faithful followers of Christ. They didn't see a lot of fruit. They looked at the Lutheran communities, the Calvinist communities, and as one of the Anabaptists wrote, it wasn't Hubmeier. I forget which one it was, but he, in one of his criticisms of the Protestant movement, he said, these Protestants live these horribly immoral lives. They come to church and just simply say, I'm sorry. Then you admit them to the Lord's Supper and they still are heathen. And that was part of the criticism. And they felt like that there was a tendency in justification by faith alone to let people compromise their conscience. Well, if God's forgiven me, I can just live however I want. Now, it was a bit of a caricature, but there was some of that that went on. And listen, don't be shocked. I mean, that goes on in evangelicalism all the time. There are people that excuse their immoral, ungodly, despicable behavior and are members in good standing of churches and say, well, God forgives me. And they just continue to live like the devil. And there are churches where church discipline is not practiced. And it's a sad state of affairs. And the Anabaptists observed some of this in the Protestant. The Protestant movement was not pure. Adultery, dishonesty, go on and on and on, happened among the Protestants just like it did in the Catholics. Protestantism was not a panacea of ethical behavior in every way. And this was kind of where the Anabaptists were coming. Our real call is God has called us to be His holy people. This is why the Sermon on the Mount and the Gospels were so important to them. You can talk about justification by faith all you want to, but we want to see the fruit. Where are changed lives and people pursuing this perfection that Christ talked about? And so that was a common element in the Anabaptists. Some were, you know, more amenable to a Lutheran justification by faith than others, but they really tended to harp on sanctification because they felt like it was the crying need of the day. All right, before we go to our small groups, let me talk about the Munster Rebellion. At least we can get this far on that. All right. Melchior Hoffman was in Strasbourg, encountered some Anabaptists there, and became a leader. And his followers, known as the Melchiorites, by 1530 were in the Netherlands. They had moved there. A very fiery preacher, continuing to pronounce that theme of prophecies that point to this being the end times and Christ returning soon, and actually made a prophecy that Strasbourg is going to be the new Jerusalem. You know, Joseph Smith decided it was Independence, Missouri. But for Melchior Hoffman, the New Jerusalem is Strasbourg. And he returns there and happily goes to prison. You know, this is the inauguration of the end. And this is going to set in motion these last events of history. Well, he died in prison 10 years later. But his ideas did pass on to other leaders in the Netherlands. And in the city of Munster, in Germany particularly, becomes Anabaptist through the preaching of a man by the name of Bernhard Rothman. And there were Anabaptists from Amsterdam that come over to Munster, and the declaration is made, no, we missed it. Strasbourg is not the New Jerusalem, Munster is. This is the New Jerusalem, and Christ is about to return. And then under the leadership of the two men you'll see listed on the slide there, Jan Matthäus and John van Leyden, notice the Dutch connection there, began to pronounce is that the kingdom of God is not going to come peacefully. We must take it by force. They required that everyone in the city of Munster, by this time it was several thousand, all of you have got to receive believers' baptism or leave the city. They believed that they were establishing the renewed kingdom of David. John van Leyden is crowned as King David and reinstitutes polygamy in Munster. Now, what do you think these Protestant and Catholic princes in Germany are thinking when tales come about kingdom of David, polygamy? These are arch heretics, and both of us want to get rid of them. And they're calling for a return of Christ, and they are very militaristic in the way they're standing. So thousands of them now gathered in Munster. The bishop and the prince, German prince there, seal off the city, and they attack the Anabaptists at Munster. They were fearful for violence as things were coming unglued there. They feared for what might happen. And in 1535... the armies go in and they slaughter all the inhabitants, and all of these Anabaptists are killed. And the story spread all over Europe. This is what Anabaptism is about. These people are crazy fanatics, and we need to get rid of all of them. They're subversive. They want to overthrow society. They're not godly. They're not Christian. And heretics, and we need to get rid of them. And this was just a horrible disaster for the Anabaptist movement, as it confirmed the fears of many of their critics and now is used as an excuse to persecute them. Lest this happen in our own backyard, we need to go after the Anabaptists where they are. And even there was an imperial mandate from Charles V himself that Anabaptists were to be executed. And the practice of rebaptism was punishable by death. And this thing just began to snowball and more violence against them. I'm going to talk about Michael and Margaretha Sattler in a minute, but here's the city of Munster. You see there in Germany where the the Dutch and some of the German people are moving there, and where this tragic end occurred. Notice this statement from Sebastian Franck, one of the early Anabaptists, by 1531, talked about the persecution that was beginning to take place. The Anabaptists spread so rapidly that their teaching soon covered, as it were, the land. They soon gained a large following and baptized many thousands. And that's not an exaggeration. There really were thousands and thousands. Drawing to themselves many sincere souls who had a zeal for God. For they taught nothing but love, faith, and the cross. They were persecuted with great tyranny, being imprisoned, branded, tortured, and executed by fire, water, and sword. In a few years, very many were put to death. So this had been taking place. And then in 1535, just 4 years after this was written, they're already killing a lot of Anabaptists. This thing at Munster happened, and you can imagine, it was just exponentially, the persecution of Anabaptists increased, and it was just a horrible scene. Yes?
But the authorities were sort of effective in stamping out, wiping out the extremist
elements. Oh, yeah. Well, particularly here they did. And it did tend to squelch some of the more extreme elements. Although many of the Anabaptist mystic leaders, which we'll talk about next week, continued with some of the themes among these people. The difference was this. What happened in Munster is they were beginning to advocate armed victory, that we're going to have to take the kingdom of God by force. They were arming themselves and the German princes. And they had left the original Anabaptist commitment to not taking up arms against others. And we'll talk next week about a little document known as the Schleitheim Confession from the 1520s, and these Anabaptists got together, and one of the things they said is, in terms of our view of the sword, Christians are not to take up the sword against anyone. In fact, to such an extreme, and this is what made the Catholic authorities furious, the Anabaptists taught their people, we really shouldn't even fight against the Turks. They want to come kill us? What would Jesus have done? He wouldn't take up arms against people that persecuted them. Well, the authorities didn't take very kindly to that. We're raising armies to fight against these Turks invading Vienna. And the Anabaptists are advocating, and this is just considered seditious. And, how dare you do that? And so, but Menno Simons will be the one, and I'll just leave you with this, because we do need to go to our groups, we're about out of time. Menno Simons would renovate the Anabaptist movement after the disaster at Munster, and one of the themes that he will articulate is a renewed commitment to pacifism, and not ever, Christians not ever serving in the army, not serving in the government, and you never resist any persecution in any shape or form. And you have nothing to do with wielding the sword. That's not what Christians do. And so, typically when you think of Mennonites today, you think of pacifists, right? And so that was an early theme among the Swiss Brethren. But with Munster, when it got twisted, then there was a nervousness about that. But long term, because of the disaster of Munster, there are not any other significant sized groups of Anabaptists that will ever be militaristic. So they did stamp it out right here. That was the end of that. And they kind of went back to their original vision of pacifism.
The preceding program has been brought to you by RTS on iTunes U and may not be reproduced or disseminated in part or in whole, for sale or for profit, without express written consent. For more information on RTS degrees and programs, please visit us at www.rts.edu or call 1-855-854-6920.